Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And welcome to What's Next. Glad to be back with you. I'm Jay Moran, and with us, a recurring guest here on What's Next. As a matter of fact, Dr. LeGarrette King from the University of Buffalo, professor of education, also the director of the Center for K through 12 Black History and Racial Literacy Education. Dr. King, great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
You have had a busy summer. We were just kind of reflecting on this, maybe a little too busy. You know that, I guess that image of the professors, you know, checking out in May and not returning until September is not really all that true, is it, huh?
Yeah, no, I haven't figured that out yet. But maybe one of these days I'll figure that out.
Maybe someone will teach you how to do that, right? So yeah, and one of the things that does keep you busy, and we've had a chance to talk about this in the past, is your annual Teaching Black History conferences. You had your 8th this summer. Let's maybe just touch upon how things went for you.
Yeah, so the 8th Teaching Black History Conference, I believe this was the 4th one we had here in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. Our theme this past year was Black Boy Joy, Black Girl Magic, the History of Black Childhoods.
Okay.
And I think that's real interesting and, you know, something that we don't really get into in terms of Black education.
Right.
Is the contributions of children and how they influence history, right? Whenever we kind of think about social change and social justice, typically who leads us are our children, right? You know, those who are, you know, 25 and under. And so this conference was in honor of them, right? So we had around 189 people come and visit us at UB downtown at the medical center. And we had 3 days of, you know, wonderful networking presentations, as well as other, you know, activities that engaged us in the concept of Black history education.
I'm fascinated about the, like you said, the contribution of Black children. Mm-hmm. to the history. Let's talk about that a little bit, because, you know, obviously you didn't set up that title if there wasn't a lot of substance there. Mm-hmm. And there has been probably a certain amount of scholarly work on it. There's probably so much you could tell us about what we don't really know, but what were some of the takeaways from the conference?
Yeah, I think one important aspect of kind of understanding how children have contributed to, you know, history. A lot of times when I may say that, people may kind of just picture, you know, Black children getting, you know, sprayed by the water hoses down in, you know, Alabama during the Civil Rights Movement. But in many ways, when I'm thinking about this notion of Black boy joy, Black girl magic, are not necessarily the painful things that had occurred towards Black children in kind of this, you know, approach to freedom, but just the everyday kind of understandings of how Black children use their agency and how Black children use their creativity and how Black children, you know, survive during, you know, particularly difficult times, right? So take, for instance, something that we don't really talk about when we talk about the history of slavery, right? Are kind of the children and how they kind of connected and stayed children, right? So, you know, the history of toys that enslaved children, you know, created, right? You know, you'll see, you know, enslaved children creating certain dolls or certain type of what we would call board games or tic-tac-toe or all these particular things are like very interesting to kind of say, we're during this kind of historic time, right, that we all have kind of connected with oppression, right? You know, Black children found a way to still be children, right, during those particular aspects of life. But yeah, but learning about, you know, Black kids and, you know, how they did certain things throughout history, I think is like extremely important for people to understand.
And to take that then, when it comes to understanding history and how you as a historian go about, and your fellow historians go about, you know, gathering and understanding it yourselves, you know, what types of materials are you utilizing when you try to dig deeper into this topic?
Yeah. So for, you know, the historians, you know, I like to call myself kind of a Black history educator.
That's true. That's true. I gave you probably not, you know, the right historian, exact title. Right? That's right. Right.
So while I know probably more history than the average person, mm-hmm. right, I wouldn't kind of connect myself as a historian going into the archives and,
right.
you know, trying to find original, you know, artifacts to kind of study and learn and piece things together. Right. So a historian kind of takes these different aspects and pieces of story together, right? Particularly a primary sources, right? So, you know, more for educators, however, you know, a Black history educator, we do take those primary sources, but then also we utilize a lot of secondary sources to kind of, you know, help us kind of teach those things that these historians have kind of connected, right? You know, together. But, you know, in terms of the teaching aspect, we had a lot of presentations that focused on not only the history of Black children, but also kind of the current realities of Black children. And how they are still making history and you know, really kind of exploring. You know, one of our keynote speakers, Javon Hunter, who is a professor at Buffalo State, reminded us a few years ago about this letter. I believe the young man's name was King, right? Was his first name. And I think it was like, it went viral on social media where there was a lesson, white teacher, King's a Black student, Black male student. And I believe this was some form of journal entry. King was critiquing the teacher on her teaching of that day. And I believe it was like a history lesson. And he was very disappointed in the teacher's approach to history and asked the simple question, can white teachers really teach Black history, right, to Black students, right? And he really, you know, helped us kind of examine, you know, King's agency and how King understood his education at that particular moment, and that, you know, these students that sit in these classrooms and learn these particular things are not just blank tablets. They have their own knowledge. They understand what they need to know. And in many ways, that history is taught in homes instead of the schools.
That's an interesting kind of look at the things there. Can a white teacher mm-hmm. teach kids Black history? So that, I mean, I'd have to believe you said you had about 190 educators there. So that probably sparked some interesting debate and discussion. You know, what were people saying?
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's a loaded question, right? Can white teachers teach Black students Black history, right? And then naturally, I think people would say, well, if black educators can learn, you know, various different things, then white educators can learn. And I think that holds true, right? I think there's, for any educator, right, there's identity work that needs to be done, you know, when we teach in diverse settings, right? So really understanding who you are and what perspectives that you come from. When you kind of understand your identity and where you're coming from, then it kind of helps you kind of understand that, oh, your students in your classrooms are coming from different spaces, whether it's culturally, racially, ethically, economically, et cetera, et cetera. And that helps you become a better teacher, right? So in this particular instance, King, you know, the young man who critiqued his teacher in the journal, which he received a bad grade from the teacher. you know, he was just saying, like, hey, maybe you need to step back, right? Kind of reexamine how you're kind of teaching this subject and then come back, you know, more improved, right? Get some professional development, you know, read books, right? Maybe, you know, examine other teachers teach, you know, their students these particular things, and then come back and become a better teacher, right? Kind of holding her accountable, right? And I think that's what, you know, teachers and, you know, anybody involved in education need to do, is hold themselves accountable, always reflect on how they're kind of approaching, and not take offense, right, to when the students kind of critique various different instructional approaches.
As you mentioned, it'd be helpful in many cases to have that kind of identity education, for lack of a better term, for teachers, so they can have, you know, maybe a better understanding, better, maybe more empathy, and maybe able to put themselves in a different situation, different space when they are teaching these topics. You can't possibly know what's going on in every school district across the country, but from your place, someone who follows the teaching of education, especially Black education, Black mm-hmm. literacy, do you think that most districts, most teachers are being availed of this type of opportunity to, like you said, kind of reflect on their own identity as they approach teaching you know, young Black children?
Yeah. So, you know, teacher education and any other kind of preparation course, teachers are always reflecting, right, on their practice, right? There has been a struggle, however, according to the literature, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and the literature is kind of the best way that we can kind of understand what's going on in the world, right? It is very difficult for teachers to teach about concepts of race, right? Particularly white teachers, when 85% of our teaching force are white women. Mm. There's more males and more teachers of color as we, you know, get, you know, older in the secondary aspects, but in elementary, it's overwhelmingly white women from the suburbs, right?
Right.
And this is not to say that, you know, white women in the suburbs can't teach diverse students, but just based on the literature, there has been some, you know, difficulties and concerns from these particular teachers about teaching topics such as Black history or other ethnic-specific, you know, histories, or teaching about race. And so that's why, like, sometimes when I hear the discourse, you know, around, you know, well, you know, the kind of woke discourse around schools,
right?
I'm like, that's just not true, right? Not on a large scale, right? Because I have probably done, I don't know, 30, 35 professional development sessions all over the country at different school districts. And from my perspective, woke is definitely not, you know, part of our vocabulary within, you know, public school education, right?
That's quite a statement. Yeah. I mean, again, we were kind of talking about this before we went on the air, how mm-hmm. there are certain assertions being made mm-hmm. on a political, philosophical level in this country that are kind of sticking to the wall. I'm saying, I use the kind of metaphor, the paint is starting to dry on these things. And that's one of them, that mm-hmm. there, you know, wokeness, DEI, out of control, you know, putting, you know, false narratives and, you know, maybe even using the term reverse discrimination, which is yeah. kind of absurd. Yeah. So, but you're saying what you see on the ground, not even close.
Yeah. So, you know, from my perspective and my other colleagues' perspectives around the country, when we are in these spaces, right, teachers are very concerned, even before kind of, you know, this discourse became popular after COVID, right? Teachers were always concerned about, well, I don't know if we should teach certain children's books. I don't think that we should teach certain histories because students are, you know, young and too young to learn about that type of history, or, you know, even, well, I don't know if we should present this history this particular way because it makes white people look bad, right? So those have always been kind of discourses from teachers who refused, right, or they were concerned, right, about teaching those particular topics, right? Right. So when there's kind of these accusations about, well, these schools are doing this and they're teaching these books about homosexuality, that's just not true on a large scale, right?
You might be able to find specific examples here and there.
Right, because of course, right? You know, like nothing's 100%, right?
But the idea of an indoctrination.
Right.
You find that just, you know, I mean, just by your reaction, you find that absurd.
Well, indoctrination is an interesting concept, right? Because I kind of challenge my students a lot of saying, well, saying the Pledge of Allegiance is indoctrination, right? You may believe that we should say the Pledge of Allegiance every single day, and there's nothing wrong with saying the Pledge of Allegiance every single day,
right?
But it's indoctrination, right? So we can argue that all type of education is indoctrination, even if you believe it. Right. Believe that to be something that's good. It's indoctrination. Right. So, no, but there's not. And there's been, you know, from my experience as a college professor, I used to teach high school as well. Is that there's a lot of pushback for various different topics that have been tried to be taught in classrooms. People are always concerned. And typically people are concerned with parents and their kind of understandings of what is going on in the classroom. So I'm kind of suspicious about that type of discourse.
Yes.
Because based on you know, my 25 years of experience, and based on my other colleagues that I talk to around the country, is just simply not true on a large scale.
So a lot of it is, I mean, it's more of this concern, maybe so and so parent might see a syllabus or a book in their child's book bag and think, what is this outlandish classwork that they're getting? This isn't the, you know, the basics that we want our kids to learn. That seems to be kind of maybe the what's getting in there.
Yeah. So you may have concerns. My wife, she's a professor of literacy education, and you know, she teaches about aspects of children's literature, right? And her students are always like, oh no, I don't know if we should teach this book about you know, a kid with two moms, right? You know, and it's always a concern. Or, you know what, we really shouldn't teach this book or read this book that about slavery or about the civil rights movement, because it makes certain people look bad, right? So, you know, there's always those, you know, concerns. And typically when you ask, I remember asking one of my students, and this was probably the most truthful answer I ever received. And I asked, I said, well, why are teachers more concerned with white parents' concerns than they are with black parents' concerns? Because black parents have been complaining to schools that they would like more black history in their schools, right? But, you know, sometimes those concerns have been pushed aside and not necessarily approached in a certain type of way. And I have a personal, you know, connection to that, which I'm not going to get on, you know, public radio. but it was a similar
sure
kind of thing with my kids, right? But yet people are always concerned about the white parents and saying, no, don't teach that type of black history in our courses, when our black parents are saying, teach that type of history in our class. And the student said, well, I think most people think that more repercussions are going to come from the white parents than they are from the black parents. So that's why we don't really listen to black parents in that particular manner more. Right. And I was like, wow, that's a very truthful, you know, from your perspective, very truthful, you know, statement, which I can kind of agree with in many different ways.
We were talking with Dr. LeGarrette King, professor of education at the University of Buffalo, the director of the Center for K-12 Black History and Racial Literacy, or Literary Literacy Education.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Sorry about that. I'm trying to read my own handwriting here. And obviously, I don't necessarily want to, because the arc of our conversation is really turning into a real interesting place, but I want to try to make sure that we get into some other things here. You know, we just talked about your most recent Teaching Black History Conference. You're getting ready for next year's as well. I suppose you're always in preparation mode.
As soon as we finish.
So next year, the conference title is going to be Black Founding Mothers and Fathers.
Yes, yes, yes. So as many people know, 2026 is, what, 250 years since the Declaration of Independence was signed, 1776 to 2026, right? So there's going to be a lot of celebrations, including, you know, here in Erie County and, you know, Western New York and such. But I bet you there's not going to be a lot of, you know, celebrations around the notions of Black founders, right? What I would call Black founding mothers and Black founding fathers, right? So our conference is going to be focusing on those particular persons, organizations that, you know, created. Now, there's two things going on in terms of Black history, right?
Okay.
So 2026 is also, you know, February 2026 is also the 100 year anniversary of Negro History Week, which is now Black History Month, right? So that's 100 years old, and that's a founding institution, right? And then, of course, you know, Declaration of Independence. So when we think about Black founders, we're not necessarily thinking about those Black persons who have connected to what we would kind of consider the United States of America, right? So yes, there were Black revolutionary soldiers, right? There were, you know, freemen who, you know, participated in the founding of the country, but there was also free Blacks who kind of helped create a country within a country, right? Meaning that since there weren't wholesale kind of participation of Black people in the founding of the country because of the great percentage of Black people who were enslaved, which they would be considered founders as well, the enslaved persons. There were other, you know, Black folk who created different institutions like literary societies. They created newspapers. They created Masonic lodges. They created all these little bitty institutions for Black citizens at that particular time and for people who were going to be free in the future. So that's how we're kind of conceptualizing what a Black founder is, you know, someone who created Black institutions within the confines of this larger institution.
So you, as you, I think you so much alluded to the idea that, you know, when you think of the founders, right, founding fathers, founding mothers, and I can't speak for you, when I just, you know, when I said it in my out loud and I pictured it in my mind, you know, I've got guys in wigs, white guys in wigs, you know.
William Harding was the first person to coin founding fathers.
Okay.
Right? In a 1920 some odd speech on, you know, kind of the connection of the United States. So he was a senator at the time. And of course he became president later.
Right.
But yes, he's founding fathers. Those are the people who were responsible for the freedom documents, right?
Right.
Freedom documents and those who participated in the, you know, Revolutionary War.
Right. So to that then, so now what you're trying to conceptualize here then is a different conversation, a conversation that, that kind of expands the definition, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
So how, you know, I'd like to think that at this stage already, even though we're a year out from the conference, you already are well aware of people that are either teaching this in the classroom right now or different types of literature or studies that have already been done about this. Well, what do you know? What can you share with us right now?
Yeah, so it, so this is probably a concept that I started around 2015.
Okay.
Right. And some people may teach this particular concept, but don't necessarily use the framing of Black founders,
right?
As something, because of course, just like you said, there's a, like a image that's etched in many people's head when we say founders of the United States, right? But, you know, Gary Nash, who's a retired professor from UCLA, was probably one of the first people that I heard talk about Black founding fathers. And there's, and this will surprise you as well. The second person I heard talk about Black founders was Glenn Beck.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we've done the show for 3 years, and that's the first time we've mentioned that name.
So in 2010, I was in grad school at the University of Texas, and I was just flipping through the, you know, channels. I believe one summer, I was just flipping through the channels, and, you know, I stopped at Fox News, and Glenn Beck, of course, had, for the young people here, Glenn Beck used to be on Fox.
Fox, he's on some other outlet now, yeah.
Maybe he's independent or something
like that. Yeah, right.
But he had this series, the summer series called Founders Fridays.
Okay.
So every Friday, he would have like a series of about different founders, right? And it was a kind of a retelling of history, right? Which was very interesting. So one Friday, I was just flipping through the channels and I saw it. Black founders, Glenn Beck. And I just sit there and I started watching it, right? So it's one of those things where someone can do good and then also do something problematic at the same time.
Sure.
Right. So the concept of black founders, I'm like, wow, I never really thought about Frederick Douglass is a black founder. Let me listen to what they're really saying. Oh, they're saying some problematic things about Frederick Douglass, about his beliefs, but black founders makes a lot of sense, right?
Okay.
So that's how I kind of, you know, came up with kind of that concept of black founders. And the history that they were telling wasn't a history that I learned or agreed with, right? Their kind of approach was more of saying that black people are more quote unquote American than not, right? That the contentiousness between black Americans and the United States is not really that deep that people are trying to make it seem, right?
Okay.
That was their kind of approach.
Sure.
Black founders, right? And whereas my approach is not necessarily about this notion of black people not having a contentious relationship with the United States, right? My whole notion is they did have a contentious relationship with the United States. That's why they created these different organizations and became founders of these black institutions because they were not allowed to participate in these other institutions, right? So, you know, there's a different framing, but the concepts are still really interesting.
Yeah, no doubt. As you talk about it and you bring it full circle to that, most certainly, you know, opens up, a lot of different types of aspects of the country. And like you said, you know, it's 100 years ago since the first, Negro History Week,
yes,
which now has become Black History Month. But there's obviously lots of other institutions that you're going to be exploring during this conference.
Yeah. So hopefully we'll receive some really interesting proposals from teachers from around the country. Usually the majority of our presenters are teachers. Mm-hmm. So we kind of give them, the theme, and they come back and they give us some wonderful ideas about the theme. So I'm sure they're going to come up with, we have a really good contingent of teachers from the Philadelphia area. So I know they're going to come with some outstanding kind of black institutions and black founders there. So I really can't wait until October, November, we start, receiving proposals, and then I can let you know about all the different types of black founders out there.
Sure. It's a very interesting aspect that may have a lot to talk about there as well. Bringing it back now and maybe away from your conferences here a little bit, some of the other work that you're getting involved in, mm-hmm. You're an Erie County History Commissioner.
Yes.
And so now we know why you didn't have any summer for yourself.
You know, I told my wife to call me commissioner.
How's that going?
She didn't buy it.
I bet that's the case. So History Commissioner for Erie County, what does that entail?
Yeah, so we help disseminate the history around Erie County. Rich Paluski is our chairperson, and of course is under the Erie County Commissioner, and they're doing a lot of you know, interesting things around the history of the Erie Canal, you know, which were coming up. And of course, in 2026, we will participate in the 250 year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence here in New York. My particular, my major kind of contribution to the commission is I'm the chair of the 2027 Freedom Commission, which will look at New York's ending of slavery. And that's going to be kind of our anniversary aspect in 2027.
So it'll be 250 years of the,
I believe so, yeah.
End of the, the slavery. Yeah. New York. So, you know, I'm not, instead of putting you on the spot in terms of, you know, what do you know, but where do you sense taking this topic? Where do you go? You know, what are you going to be looking for from that? What, you know, you can't tell the story until you know the story. So I don't want you to, you know, to necessarily jump ahead like that at the same time, but talk maybe about your process and maybe what you think, you know, maybe you have some starting blocks already of some things you'd want to explore.
You know, before I moved here in 2022, I didn't realize New York had a very rich history around, you know, enslavement and freedom, right? You know, particularly Western New York and, you know, their abolitionist, you know, movement as, you know, probably one of the last stops, right, from the Underground Railroad going into Canada, right? So I'm very fascinated about that. But what I'm trying to do is keep an open mind, you know, in terms of 2027, right? I'm looking for, you know, organizations to partner with. I think there will be, you know, a little money that, you know, we may have. Hopefully I'm not speaking out of turn. but you know, I am looking for, you know, community, you know, organizations that do this work and that we can partner with and really kind of tell the you know, story of New York. You know, we were talking about an interesting story, you know, before we got on air, and I'm like, wow, that's fascinating. And that could be one of those, you know, stories within our larger story about 2027.
Yeah, it is interesting. I guess a kind of a my friend Della Moore, who I've got the chance to know through this program down in Olean, who runs the Center for African American Development. You know, she talks about Sarah Johnson, who was the first black person, the people of Olean. She was a runaway slave from Maryland. But, you know, according to Della, you know, the people of Olean embraced her. And then the, you know, the Fugitive Slave Act was enacted. Not ironically, by Millard Fillmore, was the president who signed it into law. Of course, he's from here from Buffalo. But according to Della, the people of Olean, you know, fought back basically or protected Sarah from, you know, the bounty hunters who came from the South looking to reclaim slaves as property. So there's a lot of interesting talks about that. And also, even the little town of Warsaw out here in Wyoming County, if I'm not mistaken, and again, my history is going to be a little vague here, but I think there was a national political party that started, you know, in the mid-19th century. I think it would have been called the Liberty Party. And their main platform was anti-slavery. So and again, if you go to places out in, you know, the rural areas of Western New York, you might not necessarily think that you found a bastion of liberalism necessarily there anyway. So I apologize for digressing and perhaps maybe erroneously or not quite getting all the information correct there. But yeah, so that's got to be exciting for you to be able to kind of lead that. I mean, it's a chance, I guess, for you to kind of, you know, direct it to a certain extent.
Yeah, it's a chance, of course, to learn, right? And I'm going to try to kind of connect everything with the center that I run at the university and try to have different types of, you know, events that are connected to the 2027 commission. But I'm really excited, you know, because, of course, I'm still pretty new, you know, here. I didn't take New York history, right?
So you're from Louisiana, right?
Right. Yes. So I know all our, you know, history around slavery, but really kind of just learning, one, you know, about slavery in New York, right? Because I'm sure slavery in New York looked different, right, than it did in, you know, the lower South, the Deep South. But then also, the abolitionist history is very fascinating to me. And just like you said, with the president who signed the fugitive, you know, slave law, who was from Western New York, you know, is a real interesting story too. And I would like to learn that as well. So, it's real interesting. So I'm looking to partner, you know, with organizations and, you know, anyone who would like to, you know, either serve on the, you know, committee for 2027, also want to run different programs.
You know, you probably could have intrigued a lot of local historians and teachers by saying, you know, if you have more information, share with me. But once you said serve on a committee, it may have scared some people off.
Well, you don't have to serve on a committee, but I would like to learn more, you know, about the things that, you know, other, you know, local people are doing, you know, around, you know, the concepts of history. So
yeah, if you want to contact, it's Dr. LeGarrette King at the University of Buffalo. He's the director for the Center for K-12 Black History and Racial Literacy Education. You know, another thing that I just happened to stumble upon is an article that you wrote or was published in just January of this year. Respect is about respectable, and the respectable is in quotation mark. Mm-hmm. Respectable Black history.
Yes.
I got a feeling we have a long conversation ahead here about this, and just some of the things you're talking about. But boy, it really, it's a great article in the sense that, you know, you're taking it from a lot of different perspectives, mm-hmm. and not the least of which, and I thought this was a fascinating element of it, is just, you know, you even said it's not monolithic. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, an understanding of this. It's not, you know, all Black individuals do not have the same, you know, sense of history, mm-hmm. the same viewpoint of history, the same embracing of history. And let's get into that. I mean, you even used Liberia mm-hmm. as a fascinating, fascinating subject matter here. You know, of course, the Back to Africa movement of Liberia. Mm-hmm. But let me talk about what kind of issues evolved from that aren't necessarily easy to maybe even digest.
Yeah. So in essence, we educators, Black history educators, overcompensate
sure.
for the lack of Black history in our courses. Right. So when we do have a chance to teach Black history, we teach it in kind of this grandiose manner, right? Black people were these freedom fighters. Black people were these people, you know, they had the moral compass, you know, of freedom and equity and all these particular aspects, right? I look at history a little differently, right? Mm-hmm. History is about kind of helping us understand our humanity as society, right? You know. And as humans, you know, it's the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? And Black people are not, they're not exempt from that, right? But when I bring that up to Black history educators, you know, many of them say, yeah, but no, right? Mm. I'm not going to teach the quote unquote problematic aspects of Black history because I don't want people to think that we are these types of people because they believe history is kind of connected to this notion of identity. So they want to present this type of identity through our history as these freedom fighters, these people who have been victimized by oppression. And all that is true.
Right.
But also, you know, not all Black people, Black events, Black organizations were pristine or perfect. Right. So I bring up, the history of Liberia, right? Liberia is in West Africa, right? And those who kind of know kind of the more recent history of Liberia, people may, you know, kind of understand that they've been in civil war, right? Or have been in civil war, you know, for many years. But if we kind of think about, right, who were in civil war, then it'll help us kind of understand our U.S. history.
Okay.
Right? So, you know, in the mid-19th, you know, century, you know, there was this idea that Black people are never going to be citizens of the United States of America, right? Or not equal citizens. So there was this kind of American colonization society created to send Black people back to the continent of Africa, right? And they could create their own colonies there, particularly on Western Africa. So, you know, a lot of the first Black people who colonized what we would call now Liberia, right, were descendants, well, are U.S. black folk who decided to go back to Africa, either by force or by choice, right? Mm-hmm. And what they did when they went to and colonized, right, West Africa, is do the same thing that the English colonies, right, did to black people. They enslaved the natives, and they created this hierarchical system of racial class, right, in that particular place. So those who were descendants of black people from the U.S. were on the top, and those who were native were down at the bottom. So that's where you have this kind of civil war strife in Liberia based on the history of the United States, right? So, you know, many people, you know, would think that based on our history and what we know, that black people will go over there and, you know, co-mingle with the natives and ask if we could settle. But no, it was like, no, we're settling here and we're going to enslave you and we're going to treat you like second class citizens, just like what was done to us in the U.S. Right. You know, so those are the kind of type of history, but those are not what I call respectable histories.
Right.
Right. That's not a history that proves that we were morally superior or proves that, you know, we had some type of, you know, aspects of equality in our minds. It just kind of notes that we are human,
right?
Humans in this kind of cruel world.
It really is a fascinating way of looking at it. And I guess just to reiterate, then you, I mean, your belief is to, this needs to be there, you know, quote unquote, teaching, not teaching only respectable, quote unquote, black history.
Right. Because we're not learning history.
Right.
Right. You know, we're cherry picking different types of history. And that does us no good. Right. Now, this can kind of connect to kind of the more recent, you know, discourse around the Smithsonian and what was happening in the current administration about, well, there should be history that should make us be proud of being American, right? And that is a use of history, but you're not learning history, right? You're learning fantasy, right? Or you're learning just one part of history without telling us kind of the complete story. Because history is not about making us feel good. It's not about making us, you know, love our country. It's about helping us understand humanity. And the more we understand about humanity, the better we're going to be off as a democracy, because now we understand what we can do to kind of prevent those particular things from happening. So we can kind of connect to what we say we are as a country, and not just what we imagine we are as a country.
And you mentioned that there is a certain amount of pushback about that idea that you don't want to just teach quote unquote respectable black history. But there must be proponents as well, right? People who agree with you. Or are you right now a minority of a voice out in the desert right now?
I would say people understand. I don't know if they're going to be proponents, right? For the audiences that I speak to, educators, right? I joke all the time with people. Like when I bring up this topic, I have black educators that would say, no, we don't want to further traumatize our students with this type of knowledge. They feel that this knowledge is bad for students, particularly black students, right? And that's kind of the consensus from black educators.
Okay.
From my white educators, they're like, no, you're not going to set me up. You're not setting me up on this. I am not teaching that black people did this, right? And they did that. You're not setting me up. So my audience that I speak to the majority of the time, those are kind of the two.
So proponents is definitely not the right word.
Right, right. So those are kind of the two, you know, viewpoints. But I think people kind of understand.
Sure.
Right. I think they understand. And I believe they kind of believe and agree that a multitude of history needs to be taught. I say that as a country, we're historically immature because we can't handle talking about the bad things that we did throughout our history. Right. And because we're historically immature, we're never going to get to that particular part. Right. But I think teaching about those dynamic An interesting history is because at the least it's interesting.
Sure.
Right. But because most people connect their identity to their history, that's hard to do. Like, wait a minute. Oh no, I don't want to, you know, do that. I don't want to do this. Right. You know, for a more kind of local example, it's an interesting discourse when we talk about, well, who should be taught as Black history. Okay. I know conservatives have said, oh, we go to the National Museum of African American History and Culture and we don't see anything about Clarence Thomas. Hmm. Right.
Okay. All right.
And so then, you know, you're like, okay, well, Clarence Thomas, particularly in the concepts of Black history, is a controversial figure.
Absolutely.
Right. And then plus, right, there's always kind of this disrespect of the second, right? You know, because the first is always kind of promoted, no matter if they were historically important or not. But I think in terms of Supreme Court injustices, I think people have all the respect for Thurgood Marshall. Absolutely. So I'm not saying that Thurgood Marshall is not to be respected. But the first, it's always probably taught, and we very rarely teach about the second.
Yeah.
Right. You know, George Washington, you know, I mean, not many people are clamoring for John Adams. Right. You know,
so, sure.
You
that's
know,
true.
Right. You know, it's just that. But how should we frame Clarence Thomas?
That's
if he
a great
is
question.
A historical figure.
I mean, he has been on the Supreme Court now since the late 80s.
Right. Right.
I mean, you know, that's it's got to be among the longest tenures of any Supreme Court justice.
And he has shaped policy, right? Or shaped laws, right?
Certainly.
Based on his kind
and
of
continue
approach.
To do so.
And continue to do so, right? But for a lot of Black people, he's not a positive figure, right? Because the majority of, you know, things that he have, you know, decided on probably was against most Black people's, you know, kind of understanding of how the world should look.
Right.
But he is a fascinating figure because he was part of the Black Power movement when he was, you know, at Yale, right? And as a younger person, right? So it's a real kind of aspect. Do we treat Clarence Thomas respectably, or do we teach his full history and what he's done? And I guess that just depends on who's the person telling the story.
Well, you know, as we kind of evolved in this conversation, and what you've kind of brought up here is just that, it, you know, if it was any other Supreme Court justice,
mm-hmm.
we'd probably say, why wouldn't we take a look at Alito, or, you know, why wouldn't we take a look at, you know, whomever?
Yeah.
But in this case, you mentioned Clarence Thomas, and you know, and I'm sure we've got listeners right now or, you know, probably steaming in the ears.
Not I mean, just, probably through their pen.
Yeah,
probably,
you know,
if they didn't spit their coffee.
You're right, if they didn't kick it in. But at the same time, what you're suggesting, Aaron, and we've kind of narrowed this down now mm-hmm. to one figure, but you're back to what you were saying about how it's important, the good, the bad of history mm-hmm. needs to be discussed. And I'll let other people decide whether or not Clarence Thomas is good or bad. But like mm-hmm. I said, I think a lot of listeners are ready to kick the radio in here. You know, I guess what you're saying is he needs to be understood.
Yeah, yeah, the history, Clarence Thomas shouldn't be excluded from Black history, right? I have a particular approach that I would say that his history should be taught, right? But to ignore Clarence Thomas within the confines of Black history, I think would be a mistake, right? Going a little further, right? I think a historical person that gives Black historians and Black people fits is Booker T. Washington. Right.
Okay.
Very complex, you know, individual, depending on who you are. And Booker T. Washington used to be one of the most taught Black people in history until recently, I think, after the Civil Rights Movement, according to, you know, the study I read. You know, he kind of fell off, but he used to be a, you know, very prominent Black history figure in the
certainly.
Classrooms.
Yes.
Right? But he's controversial, right? Some people, you know, will say he was the Black conservative of the time of the early, you know, 20th century, right? You know, with his feelings of Black economics, Black education, and Black people's place in society, right? We shouldn't speak up for social justice. What we should do is keep our heads down. Work and economic justice is something that we should really focus on. And for some, that's a very controversial kind of approach, particularly when we think about that day and time, right? So again, I'm like, do we ignore Booker T. Washington, or do we kind of approach Booker T. Washington in many different ways, right? So there's so many different approaches that we could do for Black history that I think people don't really realize. And respectable history does not necessarily deal with our controversial issues or our controversial historical people. It also deals with the type of person that we decide to focus on.
Right.
Right. So Black history, typically we focus on the Black wealthy or the Black middle class. Mm-hmm. And we rarely talk about the Black poor, right? Or the Black working class,
right,
within history. So, so respectability has all different types of,
absolutely,
kind of approaches.
And I'm going to take this to another, mm-hmm, spot here. And we've obviously brought you in because it's talking about, teaching Black history and, mm-hmm, racial literacy education. That's your specialty. But I'm going to ask you this question because it just occurred to me as you brought up Clarence Thomas. And, mm-hmm, going back to it again.
Okay.
The idea that, that you can't talk about him. He's obviously a huge Black historical figure, and, there's no other way to say it. The second Black man to serve on the Supreme Court. Yet, in a lot of popular culture, he is not discussed. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, can we make a parallel? And I'm asking you for a big answer, and you can just walk past it. Mm-hmm. When you look at this cultural or political divide in this country that just seems to get wider by the day, is that maybe a part of it? That idea that, we can't, and you can take either side of the divide. Oh, we can't talk about that because we don't like that, or we can't talk about this because of that. Do you see anything in that? Back to the value of just teaching and understanding history. Does that take us somewhere here?
Yeah, maybe. To kind of clarify, I think Clarence Thomas just make a lot of Black people mad.
Sure.
Right?
It makes a lot of white liberals mad.
Yeah, and when we think about history and who we are supposedly supposed to honor, mm-hmm, right? Because to be put in a history book is to honor you.
Right.
In many ways, right? And, okay, so this person who, in many respects, as we talked about, Black folk with a certain political disposition, white folk with a certain political disposition, doesn't like this particular Supreme Court's judges and his decisions and such, does that necessarily make that person irrelevant?
Mm-hmm.
Historically irrelevant.
Right.
Right. It doesn't. It doesn't make that person historically irrelevant, particularly if we're focusing on a particular history such as Black history.
Right.
But on a larger, scale, I'm thinking about Confederate monuments and how those are coming back in sight, right? It's not a racist thing, according to the administration. It's something that they're not ashamed of in terms of their history. But then I'm always kind of asking the question of, well, why do we want to focus on people who were really, number one, not really part of the country? They were rebels to the country, and they tried to destroy the American way of life at that particular moment, right? Or they didn't want their American way of life to be destroyed, right? Mm-hmm. Type of deal, right?
Yep.
It's weird. I I say this for those who may be religious, right? Who may go to church. I may have read this somewhere. If your church just started to have pictures of Lucifer all over your church, right? Lucifer or the devil, right? Yes, Lucifer or the devil is part of your history, if you're Christian or whatever the case may be, right? But wouldn't you start to question what the purpose of this church is or the ideology of this church is if you see all these pictures and statues of Lucifer in your church, right?
Right.
And that's the way I kind of see this notion of history and how history is supposed to represent us. If history is supposed to represent us, then, hey, how do we represent ourselves, right? So going back to Thomas, does Clarence Thomas represent Black America? Again, that goes to an individual person to kind of decide based on the people that I know, he doesn't,
no,
right, in many different ways and in terms of his ideology. So should there be a statue of Clarence Thomas within these particular, if the National Museum of African American History does, you know, has statues of different people? I don't know.
Right.
But he definitely does not need to be excluded within the history and the historical narrative, particularly since we've had the Supreme Court for a very long time. And there's only been two black, now three, black persons who have, you know, connected, to the Supreme Court.
Dr. King, you took us on quite a journey here. I mean, you should go back to teaching history in the classrooms. I think we'd all line up and be part of it. I really appreciate you coming in and not only talking about your work, but just giving us nice, I think, a lot of food for thought here on What's Next. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Dr. LeGarrette King has been a frequent guest here on What's Next. He's the director of the Center for K-12 Black History and Racial Literacy Education at the University of Buffalo with us today on What's Next. This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.